Dr. Anne Rowe is the author of 5 books. There's a book on American politics, there's a biography of Pontius Pilate, a history of life in a medieval town in France, and most recently, a really beautiful book on Orpheus, the half-man, half-god of Greek mythology who went into hell to rescue his wife. Politics, poetry, history, mythology, all of that suggests to me a woman who's driven by an intense curiosity for a whole lot of different things. And for that kind of mind, Anne has the perfect weekly job. Anne Rowe is the obituary editor for The Economist magazine in London. And for Anne Rowe, writing the page begins with the task of singling out one life out of the millions that have just that week come to an end. And everyone, from the great and the good to the villains and the obscure, gets just one page. Anne Rowe was recently in Australia as a guest of Adelaide Writers' Week. Hello, Anne.
Hello, Richard. Great to be on the show.
I've just read recently an obituary you wrote on King Richard III, whose remains were found in a car park in Leicester. I'd really love you just to read the opening paragraph of that, because it's just kind of fabulous. Would you mind?
No, not at all. Right, here it begins. No viper, toad or hedgehog, no unformed bearwhelp or lump of foul deformity. Instead, the man dug up from the car park of Leicester Social Services in September had for the most part an ordinary shape. His height was a little above average for the time when he had lived. His limbs were regular and delicate, almost feminine, the scientists said. Parche Shakespeare, there was no withered arm. There was, however, a severely sideways twisted spine, the result of scoliosis that had probably emerged in adolescence. It would have put one shoulder higher than the other, making him stand shorter than he was. He might have needed extra cushions in his chairs and extra tugs when putting on those robes of green velvet and crimson cloth of gold so lovingly detailed in his orders to the wardrobe. But then a king would get that sort of help anyway.
Straight away, Anne, I hear the kind of lovely contrast in that obituary between, you know, Shakespeare's immortal villain and those mundane bones found in a car park straight away.
That's right. It was the most wonderful story, that one. And it was a very self-indulgent obit. I mean, I didn't have to do it at all, you know, an obit of a man that old. But I suddenly felt we've got the real man here. We've never had him before. We've only known the monster. Okay, let's try and do an obit of the real man. And of course, the monster kept creeping in at the side. You know, it's such a powerful image that Shakespeare's given us. And of course, we don't really know the answer to all the mysteries about Richard. So the obit was kind of going back and forward a little between the man we now felt we knew with all the wound marks on him and everything else, and the sort of demon man who's still in our heads. And it was a great one to do. It was a real bit of self-indulgence, that one.
People from that long ago can seem like aliens from another planet to us sometimes. Is it really important to you to try and imagine yourself into the life of the person you're writing an obituary for?
No, definitely. I mean, whether as far back as that or whether just last week, you've got to get into their heads, I think, and behind their eyes somehow. And I think when you write an obituary of someone, you don't want it to be your voice and you don't want to be passing judgment on them because you're continuing. But the person that's left the world has left, you know, has left their own particular way of looking at it. They no longer have that, and I'm saying this rather badly, but there's a particular way we all have of looking at the world. And when someone dies, that way of looking, that particular eye on the world disappears. And that's the one you've got to somehow recreate in what you do, I think. We've got to know that particular way of seeing things. And so I try to go back always to what they've written or what they've said, or in the case of people as old as Richard, you even go back to bits of their handwriting or little bits of their clothing or tiny little bits of documentary evidence about them, anything that sheds a little light on the actual man, the physical person, what they were doing, what they were thinking.
You know, there's that old cliche that says when someone dies, a library burns. Do you feel that sense of loss all the time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And sometimes you feel it extremely. I mean, I did an obit once of a woman who was the last speaker of a particular Indian language in Alaska. And I found that in this language, There was a whole library of words to describe a spruce tree, for example. And there's no other language that has so many words to describe all these different bits of the spruce. And I thought, that whole understanding of that tree has now gone. And so my obit was rather largely made up of these almost unpronounceable words. I mean, the woman who did the audio version of The Economist has never spoken to me since. These appalling tongue twisters to say, but I was wanting to say, these words have gone, and this particular way of looking at this tree has gone. Yes, I do feel a sense of loss, but actually most lives are long lives these days. You know, people die in their 90s and their 80s, and you feel, yes, they've done a good deal there, and that's fine. The only sense of grief and loss I get about the obituary job is when it's someone young and you feel they really haven't begun to make their mark. You know, there's a potential that hasn't been explored, and that, I think, is always sad. But a life that's been well-lived, or not even well-lived, but just actively and interestingly lived, you just feel nothing but fascination with it.
And what's your brief as an obituary editor, and what constraints are you writing within the page?
Well, 1,000 words is one constraint. I guess that's almost the only constraint. I mean, I can do what I like otherwise. Because we're The Economist, there's sometimes a little bit of pressure to do, you know, a rather boring development economist or an investment banker or someone. And I try and fend those gently away, because I feel there's so many of those sort of people in the rest of the paper, I don't want to do them on my page, unless they're very interesting for some other reason. That's the constraint. I mean, when someone very big dies, I think you have to do them no matter what. Sometimes the heart sinks, because you feel, well, I can't do this. And then someone says, well, why don't we do 3 pages on them? And I always feel that's a little bit of a cop-out, because I think whether you're a so-called great man or a man who sweeps the street, 1,000 words should be everybody's portion. You know, I think there's a great equality in death, and there should be an equality in obits too.
I like that very much. The idea that everyone gets a page, whether it's Richard III or a more obscure person who might be really emblematic of something or other that's important. So how do you choose, then, who to write about in any given week?
Well, I think I ask myself, is this a good story? That's the main thing. Either is it a good story because just of the narrative and what has happened in it, or is it someone who's been particularly conflicted in their life and there's an interesting moral, there's a moral to their life somehow. I'm trying to think of people I've done recently. I mean, last week, for example, I did a princess of Sweden who had to be hidden away, who had to be the sort of woman who was never seen because she wasn't allowed to marry the Crown Prince of Sweden. And she was actually also a poor girl from Wales. So that was rather a good tale of this woman who never was. And this week I've done one of the plotters against Hitler, who was also a soldier in the Wehrmacht. And you had to ask yourself, you know, this is a soldier under orders, but it's also someone who wants to kill the commander-in-chief. You know, what are the conflicts that go through a mind in that case? And so, yes, I'm looking for some of the conflict, I think, in the story. I mean, sometimes I'm just having fun and enjoying myself. I did an obituary of a fish once. I don't know whether you've heard of that.
No, I haven't. What fish was that?
That was a fish called Benson the carp, who was the most caught carp in England. People kept catching her and putting her back again.
Oh, sorry, and you mean an individual fish?
This is an individual fish.
Right.
So I did it from the point of view of the fish, and I was kind of lurking round on the riverbed. You know? It was wonderful to try and imagine myself being a fish. I had a great time.
Is there a certain way you need to begin an obituary?
Well, I think only the way you have to try and begin every news story, which is with a good hook, you know, talking of the fish. you've got to get the reader in there. I mean, looking at that Richard III obit, I'm a little worried that I've started with the word no, because I was told very firmly by my first editor on The Economist, never start with no, because the reader immediately wants to go away from a negative.
What nonsense that is. How good to surprise people. I was going to say, I noticed the Economist obituary for Hunter S. Thompson begins with, there were always way too many guns around at Hunter S. Thompson's farm. Did you write that?
Yes, I did. I had huge fun with that one, I must say. Yes, that was That was a good one. I mean, there you just kind of get inside this wild head. And yes, I sometimes do feel I'm sort of slightly taking on the character of the person, whether rightly or wrongly. I mean, certainly I feel that in some of my biographies, that I seem to kind of get into the mood of the person I'm writing about. And sometimes it's quite an alien mood. And it does rather worry me. I mean, I wrote a biography of Pontius Pilate some years ago, and I used to get in quite black moods sometimes writing that. I used to call them my Pilate moods, because they certainly weren't anything that I normally have. They were sort of just a complete fury with life. And I thought maybe that was something getting through to me from the deep past.
Pontius Pilate's an interesting character to write a biography about. If you read the Old Testaments, to me, he always struck me as the New Testaments, in the Gospels, it's full of people who have visions and see things, and they seem like ancient characters. And then there's Pontius Pilate, who seems really recognisable as a modern politician. Does he strike you that way?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, he's one of these characters in history who's never grown old, and people always feel they know him. I mean, when I would talk to people about him, they'd say things like, oh, you know, I can imagine having lunch with him, or yes, I think he might have gone to Radley, you know, which is a famous public school. And people simply don't kind of put him back as an ancient Roman. They sympathise with him so much that he's continually being reinvented. And really, the book was about that. It was about everyone's reinventions of Pilate, put beside the very slim evidence we've got of what his own life was like. But I simply love the reinterpretations of people and the way, as soon as someone kind of passes into history and becomes a character, then immediately the stories, whether true or false, start encrusting them like barnacles, really.
What sort of tools do you use to imagine your way into a person's life?
Well, for the obituaries, I try and find any autobiography that's been written or interviews that people have given. I watch them a little bit on YouTube if I can, although, you know, usually you haven't got them young then. That's the sort of thing. I try and home in on their words, the words they use and the little incidents that they think are important, and particularly incidents, say, from childhood, when they suddenly realise what their path in life was going to be. I always think those moments are very interesting. And suddenly they seem to realise why they're there. I always remember there's a bit in the life of Pavarotti where he says, you know, he was singing around the kitchen one day, and when he was about six, and he leapt on the kitchen table and started to sing, and all his aunts applauded. And he suddenly realised, yes, I'm going to do this. This is my life. And I love getting to that moment in a life and finding out why people think that's vital. But I also like noticing the particular words they use and prefer, and then trying to get those words into the obit a bit and their way of describing things. So I try to adopt another voice. I mean, I suppose in the end it's all going to come out a little bit in my voice as well. But I wish I could totally remove myself. That would be my real ambition, my real, you know, greatest achievement, I would feel, if I could disappear entirely and it could just be them speaking.
I think I know what you mean. Your job isn't a million miles different from what I do on my program here every day. And part of immersing yourself in someone's life, I think, is not a conscious process. It's immersing yourself. So you have this stuff come at you. You read it or you watch stuff, and you just absorb it without really consciously trying to absorb it a lot of the time. And that seems like the unconscious mind plays a role in that. Does it feel that way to you?
Yes, a little bit. It does. And I never know whether it's just, what would I call it, that almost intellectual arrogance to think that you can get inside the mind of somebody else, or whether in fact there is somewhere a kind of communication between us all, you know, that we're all in some way linked together, and that you can, in fact, if you read enough about somebody else or in the words of somebody else, you can begin to get a sort of sympathy that is a connection with them. I mean, I do often feel that every sound that's ever been made in the universe and every note of music is still reverberating somehow, and every word that's been spoken. And therefore, I feel there are ways back. You know, there are still ways of connection with people, wavelengths, literally. We talk about being on someone's wavelength. I think it probably is, you know, possible at some level of consciousness, which is probably a higher level than we normally operate on, it is possible to make links with people. And therefore, you find to your surprise that actually you are in a different place and you are looking at the world with different eyes. I do find this, and I don't think it's just me imagining things for myself. I think it is happening.
Is the cause of death important when writing an obituary?
I don't usually think so. And in fact, I don't give it most of the time because it's usually complications of old age or something like that in my case. But sometimes it is rather important when it has some connection with the life. I mean, if a mountaineer dies mountaineering, for example, I think you do want to mention that. Or where it's a suicide. And suicides are very, very difficult to deal with.
Why?
Because they're usually not explained at the time you're writing about them. You're writing too soon, and usually there's going to be an inquiry and an inquest and that kind of thing. And so you're writing in the dark, and you don't quite know the circumstances. Yes, what was the last one I did? Aaron Schwartz, who was a young man who downloaded a lot of stuff on the internet and was seen as a sort of hero for people who want the internet to be totally free of government regulation. And he committed suicide, and people didn't really know why. And only last week there was a great big article about him in The New Yorker, which went rather more into all his physical and mental problems. And I'd known none of that when I wrote about him because it hadn't been made generally available. And I don't know even whether if I'd called the family, they would have told me about it. And so there was a kind of whole different view of him, which I hadn't had access to. So I'd had to tread really carefully and not speculate. It is just a very delicate moment, I think, and you have to try not to let the suicide overshadow the life, and at the same time you have to try and make a little bit of sense of it. So I just do find that's hard.
Yes, there's a temptation, I think, a lot of the time to write about the person's life as all leading up to the suicide, as the suicide yes. overshadows every element of that person's life, and it almost seems like it was planned.
Very much. Exactly. Although actually the suicides I've known in my own life, it seemed to be almost a kind of a moment of desperation, which probably hadn't even been thought about very coherently at all and might have been regretted later. You know, that's what it has seemed like. So I think they are incredibly difficult to deal with. Mm.
When you are writing an obituary in general, do you speak to the close family?
No. No, I never do unless I am absolutely stuck for a picture or something like that. Sometimes it is very difficult to get one. No, I don't, because I feel that I'm getting their view of the person and not the person's view. So I try never to do that. I just never have. People are always a bit surprised then, because I think they feel that you would get, you know, the deepest view of somebody from the close family. But I don't think you do. I mean, when I think about myself, I don't reveal my deepest self to anyone close to me. I never tell my husband, for example, what I'm writing until the book's published, more or less. You know, all these thoughts that are going through my head all the time, I don't communicate to anybody. And so I therefore don't think that any close members of a family really know as much as they think they do about someone. And no, I always just go back to the voice itself. Even if there's a danger that people are going to misrepresent themselves, well, then I'll let them misrepresent themselves. And perhaps, you know, perhaps some other fact will shed an interesting light on that and we'll start to question it. But I would rather have the subject's own view all the time.
I imagine close family would, if you spoke to them, try and urge you to write a eulogy, but you're not writing a eulogy, are you? And having read your obituaries and, you know, obituaries in the Daily Telegraph in the UK, for example, I'm really impressed by how often irreverent they are compared to obituaries that are written in Australia, which are, funnily enough, for a nation of purported larrikins, are often rather reverent and solemn things. It's not a eulogy, is it?
No, it mustn't be a eulogy, certainly not. I mean, I think obits in Britain changed a lot in about the 1980s. There was a famous obituary editor on the Daily Telegraph and another on the Independent. Their names just escape me at the moment, but they were the pioneers, if you like, of writing a no-holds-barred obituary. And they did some wonderful things. They still do. I mean, I still think the Daily Telegraph is completely unsurpassed when it comes to, you know, mad aristocrats, I would say. They're such a fantastic read. And they are absolutely candid and quite frighteningly so sometimes.
Lord Fotherington Thomas described him as a contemptible bastard and a tiresome bore. I mean, I love reading that in an obituary. Have you written an obituary like that at all? Have you been that curt and dismissive?
No, well, the trouble is the Telegraph does them. And then I feel I can't cap that. I just say this is wonderful. I can't do any better than that. And mine would only be a pale imitation of it. I mean, sometimes I can write little things in. I remember when I did an obit of Lucian Freud, the painter, who had a notoriously dissolute private life. And I remember writing, you know, he left many children. Nobody had ever managed to count how many there were. I think none was legitimate. And, you know, you can put little things in like that. But I think this kind of wildly irrelevant and funny obituary, I've never quite managed to do it. And one of the reasons is that I always find a vein of sadness in these people. And I think often in my obituaries, there is a kind of nostalgic, rather poignant side, because I do find human life very poignant, you know, even when it seems to be funny, because I've done obits of comedians like Danny LaRue, for example. And you always find when you do these people that there is a vein of sadness running through the life, which they're covering up with the fun, if you like. And therefore, I can't quite do the rollicking part of it. I always feel there's something else going on in this life, and that's got to come out too.
Is that why you thought Anna Nicole Smith was a good subject for an obituary, the very pneumatic, sometimes film starlet who married
a millionaire? Yes, indeed. Yes, she was very pneumatic. And all the men on the paper, the young men, were saying, oh, you've got to do Anna Nicole Smith and have a picture of her with the boobs and so on. And I thought, fine. But of course, behind this sort of rollicking image, there was this poor girl from the South who wanted to be Marilyn Monroe and couldn't quite manage it. And so there was this contrast. I love contrast like this. Behind, you know, this kind of wildly lipsticked character the young men were all lusting after, and this rather sad girl who just wanted to be noticed. I was very pleased to do that obituary in a way. I just felt to get the balance between those two things was quite a challenge, and I hoped that I could do it in the end. I did get into a lot of trouble with the more prudish readers who thought, when I went into how wonderful her breasts were, they thought I was being sexist and so on. But I think she herself was enormously proud of her breasts and wanted people to notice them. And so, to my mind, that was not in the least sexist. That was just reflecting her view of the world by writing about them like that. I do sometimes have a bit of a war with my more prudish readers and also with my woman readers, because there's always far fewer women than men among the obituaries, which is just a reflection of women still not leading half such interesting lives as men do. I have always to defend the corner and say, no, I'm not being, you know, prejudicial or being discriminating against women. That's just the way the world still is.
One thing they all have in common is that they're gone and they're not coming back, or the subjects for your obituary. Do you wonder often about where they've gone, if there's some kind of afterlife that they've gone to?
Well, I absolutely believe in an afterlife, yes. I mean, I believe in an afterlife at a higher level than ours at the moment. I just feel this very strongly from members of my own family who've died. I mean, my father died only a month or so ago, and my mother-in-law also, who I was very fond of. I always feel that those who've died move into a kind of relationship with us which is even closer than when they were here. And it's a very interesting relationship and certainly very intimate. And I don't feel that the dead have gone at all. I never feel this. I feel they're, as I say, at another stage and having another life with new adventures in it, which is really very exciting. And I also felt when both these old people died very recently that they were moving on consciously, that they felt they were moving into some more interesting realm, and they'd lost interest in the world itself. They were not interested in Earth life anymore, but there was something more they were going to. I'm a great believer, incidentally, in the soul, and I do believe in the human spirit and in the soul, and that is why I'm trying to get back to the essential spark, if you like. You know, what makes a person particular? What makes them them? It's incredibly important for me to try and unearth this, and to try and unearth any feeling these people have that they've got a higher part of themselves and they're trying to live up to a higher calling and a higher potential. I mean, some of them, of course, don't have this feeling at all, and it would be very wrong of me to impose it on them. But very often there's this sense that they've got some higher calling and they've got to fulfil it, and that's fascinating to me.
And your most recent book is on Orpheus, the mythical figure, the half-man, half-god, whose music could attract the animals of the forest and move the stones on the ground. The book's got an interesting dedication. It's dedicated to, you say, to everyone who protested, but Orpheus isn't real. How real is Orpheus to you, then?
Well, he's enormously real. I think all these characters in history who have not died, whose stories keep on enthralling us and whose stories we keep on reenacting, they become real characters. They're in our pantheon of, you know, as you say, half gods, half men. And I would say someone like Mercury is another figure who's pretty well in that category. I talked about Pontius Pilate a little earlier. I mean, he's a real figure, but he's also become, you know, somebody who lives on with us. There are so many historical characters, half mythical and half real, who are still very much part of our vocabulary. We know their stories and we invoke their names. And as long as we imagine them as vividly as that, then they're real, as far as I'm concerned. You know, there is this whole world of imagination, which I think is also a world that's real. People that are imagined are people who are real. I keep talking about this sort of stage of consciousness above what we know at the moment, and I do feel very strongly there is a power of the imagination that brings things to be, and that we've created this, therefore it lives. And, you know, that is a life as real as a person who has, you know, who has lived and died and been put in the ground. Even if we have not seen this person that's lived and died, or we imagine has lived and died, we have made that person, we've created it ourselves. And therefore it's real. I mean, there's these layers of reality I feel very aware of myself, and I sort of like to make other people feel aware of them also.
The story of Orpheus, the most well-known part of his story is, of course, he marries Eurydice. She's bitten by a snake on her foot and she dies. And Orpheus is so overcome with grief and can't accept it. And so he travels into the underworld and pleads with the god of the underworld, Hades, to be allowed to bring her back. He makes the bargain saying, yes, you can lead her out, but you mustn't turn back and look. And, of course, he does, and she disappears, and she's lost to him forever. Apparently, I understand, and I'm sure you know more about this than I do, that this story of a man going into hell to rescue his wife or someone close to him is replicated in other cultures, like in Native American cultures, that could never have heard the Greek story before. They could never have heard it. What do you think this says? It must draw on something that's deep and universal. What is the thing it draws on, do you think?
But it seems to me it draws on the very fundamental fact that in order for something to grow, in order for a seed to grow, it has to go down into the earth, it has to go down into the dark and then up into the light again. There's this sense of progression in human life from kind of light through the dark and up to the light again. And we think of it in our own lives. We think, well, you've got to go through a certain period of darkness and pain in order to grow, in order to develop. And there's always this sense that we have a circular progression from the light and back to the light. I mean, even if you don't believe in the soul, I mean, as I do, you can still think that there's a human progression that has to go through some period of dark. And so I think this is an enormously fundamental story. It's the cycle of nature, the fact that No, we're dealing with the cycle of nature here, that you have to have death in order to have new life. You know, you have to have the season of winter in order to get the spring. And that's so basic and fundamental to human existence, to human survival, that I'm not surprised that this story turns up, as you say, in Native American legends. It turns up in Japan. Yes, almost everywhere, but I think most strongly in this rather strange story of Orpheus going down. The strange thing about his visit to the underworld is, of course, it's not successful, and he doesn't manage to bring her back again. And it is a tale that's very untidy, and I think maybe one of the reasons that it stayed with us is that there are so many different interpretations of it and different versions of it. And in some of them, he does manage to bring Eurydice back again. In others, he doesn't even go to find her. He just goes to commune with the darkness. And so it's the playing about with this story and all the loose ends, which I think means in some ways we're still trying to complete this story ourselves.
And then there's his death, the death of Orpheus. He's torn to pieces by a horde of naked, orgiastic women who literally tear him to pieces, and I think they eat him as well. I think, they're called the Bacchae. What do you make of that?
Well, I think, again, this represents the very fundamental truth that at death, everything is dispersed. You know, the body is dispersed and it becomes part of new nature, and that until the body is broken up and until it dissolves, you can't get the new growth again. So this is very fundamental legend in nature that, again, you're epitomising or you're kind of mythologising by having the figure of Orpheus torn apart. There's a wonderful poem by Shelley called Adonais where he talks about John Keats and how when he dies, he's made a part of nature. And he says, you know, you become a part of what once you made more lovely. And so when the poet becomes a part of nature, you know, his words go back into nature, his imaginings and the life that he's lived become a part of nature as it's seen by all succeeding generations. So everything that happens in the world dissolves and becomes a part of the world. Again, a very fundamental legend here. And it's interesting that for the ancient Greeks, this dissolution of Orpheus was the most important part of the legend. It wasn't going down to the underworld. It was the fact that he'd been torn apart. And if you look at the representations of Orpheus on the old Greek vases and so on, they do tend to show him at the moment of death, just as the Bacchae are coming along and throwing their spears at him.
Anne Rowe, that was such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for being my guest.
That is a great pleasure, Richard. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.